now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and The Sunday Times. Now with goals.
Hello and welcome to The Game. I'm Gabriel Marcotti with a football podcast from The Times where Premier League fans can get every goal, every game, everywhere. A reminder that we're going on the road. And Rory K. Smith will be joining me as well. We're excited. We're going up to Birmingham on the 25th of October. Then we'll be heading to Newcastle. Tony, are you joining us in Newcastle?
I believe I am in Birmingham.
On Birmingham.
But there is an injunction forbidding me to go to Newcastle.
Oh, that's still in effect, isn't
it? Yes. Still in effect.
It's an old story involving, of course, Mike Ashley, Sir Freddie Shepherd, and houses of ill repute. So we won't go there. To book, you can visit www.ctickets.com/thetimes, or you can call a real live human being at 0871-620-4025. That's 0871-620-4025. Remember to tell them I sent you when you call. Back to the present, and a welcome to my guest for today. It's Tony Evans making his first appearance of the season. It's Rory K. Smith, and from beautiful downtown Ripondon, perhaps from his conservatory, perhaps with a cup of tea, it's Ollie K. All right, let's get started at Anfield. It's Liverpool. It's Crystal Palace. Liverpool are joint top of the table. Tony, you're on. It's appropriate to ask you, did you see this coming?
Well, yeah, when you looked at the fixtures, you could see it was a relatively easy run.
Manchester United?
Yeah, well, you know, it's they changed the manager and they haven't exactly upgraded. It's not been a difficult start to the season, but they've done what they needed to do. They've taken the points. You could argue that they dropped points they'll regret against Southampton. But for the most part, they've played... The plate okay. Suarez is back. Sturridge is flying. Still not sure about the balance of the midfield. And still not sure that Rodgers has got the squad he needs to compete to for the title. But, yeah, it's better than it could be.
Ollie, let's talk about this because for a long time there was this mantra, perhaps an unfair one, but probably an apt one, that so many teams in England all played the same and British managers wouldn't change formation and players in England weren't adaptable to different schemes and different systems. Now you've got, you can call it a 3-4-3, a 3-4-1-2, whatever you think is more apt. This is different. It's unusual. He's done it on the fly. Should we be giving props to Rodgers for having the tactical cojones to go and do something like this?
I think so. I think he deserves credit for a lot of what he's doing. I think he's doing a really decent job with what I don't regard as a title-challenging squad or team at all. I think if they're in a position to be challenging in a few weeks' time, I mean, I would say that they will have done extremely well because he's not a great team. And he's found a balance with this team which seems to be working well. I don't think they've produced a single great 90-minute performance by any means this season, but they're doing well. The 3-4-3 seems to suit them. I think it plays to the strengths of the central defenders. I think when Johnson comes back, it will suit them more. And it seems to suit the front players. I'm just never quite sure about the balance in midfield. I don't think they've found the ideal combination with Gerrard. But I think I think from Rodgers' point of view, yeah, he's come up with something that suits them.
Well, I think, you know, you've got to look at him where he was this time last year. You know, they were winning the pass and he had this inflexible system. And I think he's grown in the course of a year. Plus, he's got a squad that's not necessarily his choice. He wanted a number 10 during the summer. And, you know,
what's wrong with Coutinho?
He's injured.
He'll be back.
He looks very frail to me. And whether he will be frequently injured is a good question. But he wanted a number 10. And the transfer committee got him a load of centre-earths. I mean, a minibus full of centre-earths. You know, it's more centre-earths than a football club should have. So he's doing well, but where he's got, you've got to praise him.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think they need a number 10 so much of the problems. I think they do have Coutinho who can play there. There's a couple of players you could drop into that position. And Coutinho and Johnson, when they come back, will make that system look a lot better. To be honest, I saw them at Sunderland. I've only seen highlights of the Palace game. Saw them at Sunderland, and it wasn't a particularly popular opinion when expressed publicly. But I thought the front two worked fine. Moses did okay in a number 10 role that doesn't suit him. The defence was all right. But there's just this vast space in midfield, and they look really unbalanced in midfield.
They didn't play well at Sunderland. I mean, as Ollie said, they haven't played well for long periods of games. But if you're not playing well and winning, that's a good thing.
Well, it is a good thing to a point. It's not ideal not ever to play well. That's not good. It's good if you can not play well and win, but at some point, if you're not playing well, you'll stop winning.
The only good thing is winning.
That thus spake Jose Mourinho. But the other thing I would say with Liverpool is that central midfield is a problem. I think it is an unbalanced squad. I don't understand why they've got. I think they've got seven senior centre backs. If you count Ilori as a,
I've told you it's a mini bus full.
It's remarkable.
There's thousands of them.
But they didn't let Stürtl go. Does Napoli were in for Stürtl and made them a loan offer? And Rodgers said to Stürtl initially in the summer, "You can't go." Then said, "You can go." And then signed two centre backs and said, "No, you can't go." It's bizarre.
That's because was supposed to be going to Barcelona. But the thing is, you know, again, everyone says, you know, and then Rodgers doesn't sign, the transfer committee does it. And, you know, it's not necessarily giving the manager what he wants, but he's doing well with it.
I'd quite like to see Liverpool play a true of 3-4-3, to be perfectly honest, rather than the 3-4-1-2. I think when Coutinho comes back, if you have an actual sort of front line of three, that might suit them a little bit better.
Ollie, I want to get your take on this transfer committee. Can you just explain a little bit what the thinking is, and is the idea part of the idea to avoid future Joe Allen situations? Or Fabio Borini,
well,
for that matter.
More than that, to avoid all future Andy Carroll situations. I mean, Liverpool issue. Going back over the course of... Well, you can say
but Brendan Rodgers wasn't the manager who signed Andy Carroll, right?
No. So Brendan Rodgers was the manager who let him go out on loan without having a striker. That's the issue. It's not about the previous regime. It's about this regime.
Ollie,
I would say it's about the situation that they inherited, where there was a, you know, this ownership inherited, where they realised very quickly that there was this club recruited very badly and was wasting an awful lot of money on wages, on transfer fees, and was doing things very badly. They then appointed Camoli, who seemed to find a different way of doing things badly. And, you know, and since Rodgers arrived, I mean, they've overspent on Joe Allen. Barini didn't work, and I think they're just trying to find different ways of not making it work. But to be fair to them, Sturridge has been a great signing. Coutinho looks like a very good signing. This transfer committee is far from perfect, very clearly, but it's I would say they've probably signed more good players over the past two transfer windows than most clubs in the league, certainly. And I think they've come out the last two transfer windows stronger, but I thought they should have done more and more varied business in the summer.
I agree completely with that, in that I think they needed a midfielder. They looked short in midfield, and I think that's the big miss. I think it's strange that they didn't sign at least one fewer central defender. I'm surprised that three of Britain's foremost football thinkers, you, Gab, Kay and Evans are being so kind of recidivist about transfer committees. Every club has an equivalent. It's just that Liverpool have made the mistake of giving it a name, which means people have got to stick to beat it with. Every club has something like this: a technical director, a chief scout, a manager. They get together and they discuss targets.
They do. But one of the interesting thing about Liverpool is, in most of these cases, the manager has the final say and the manager has the most influence. That is not the case at Liverpool,
and I don't think it should be the case. I think that's an incredibly short termist way of looking at things.
It might well be, but it's very unusual in the game over here.
Actually, thank you, Roy, for putting words in my mouth, because I was just asking questions about the transfer committee. I wasn't suggesting that.
How do you feel about the transfer committee, Gab?
Well, I'm just a presenter. I don't have any opinions. But since you gave me the idea to put words in people's mouths, you take on Crystal Palace, because when I look at this, I see some really poor players who punch above their weight, I think. People like, oh, Jedinak, he's such an elegant passer, but the guy doesn't really move more than 5 yards in either direction. And yet he still manages to be effective. I saw that weird sequence with Jimmy Kebbe, and I kind of wondered, like, this guy's a Premier League player? Does Ollie belong at this level? Is there a broader message here that actually, even if you don't have a great squad, you can compete?
Well, it's a bit of a mishmash of, I mean, it's a real, you know, a bit of a motley crew. If you look at their squad, their team, it's a combination of players who did well for them in the Championship last season, players who have been signed from other clubs who have been relegated, and you know, people like Shamak and Kevin Phillips. I don't think it all looks rather thrown together, and I think that's often what happens when teams come up in the playoffs and they don't know quite how much money they've got to spend, and they're a little bit further behind in terms of trying to do their business in the summer. So you look at that squad, that is not a squad that looks destined to stay up. But then neither did the Blackpool team that Holloway took up, and they came extremely close with something like 39 points, and he seems to find a way of making not especially gifted teams work. At the moment, they've only got 3 points. They've lost 6 out of 7, and they look like they are relegation fodder. But there seems to be something in pretty much every match I see from Palace that makes me think they're not going to be sort of Derby County circa 2007. They are going to win games at some stage. They are going to make a fight of it, and they are going to at least go down fighting if that's what it takes. But you look at that squad, it is nothing like as good as perhaps 19 others in the Premier League.
But what's interesting is obviously Palace are one of the teams that try to play. West Brom are a side that, on the other hand, you can debate how much they try to play, but they obviously have a knack for doing well against bigger teams. And Tony, against Arsenal, praise to the hilt now because it's their flavour of the month, West Brom should have won that game, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, they're playing well. I mean, they did the business late in the transfer window, and you did throughout August. You looked at them and you thought they're going to have problems, but they've got themselves sorted. They press really well. They play a style of football that will unnerve teams like Arsenal, and yeah, quite impressed with them. You know what? One of the things, you know, you're talking about Crystal Palace, you're talking about Arsenal. Increasingly, I think in the game there's too much emphasis on talent. Everyone's looking for talent. Everyone's looking for the lazy asses who can pass a ball but won't do anything. You know what? Work rate, the teamwork, working for the people around you can bring you up a level that you can compete against the talented lazies.
Talented lazies. Yeah, I see. Yeah, I just thought of you, Roy.
I couldn't get the words out. It's Monday morning. My brain's running faster than my mouth can.
Ollie, well, one thing that struck me about Arsenal, and I saw them in midweek against Napoli as well, and this might be perhaps what we refer to when we talk about some of the issues with their squad depth. And we're all aware, obviously, that something happens to Giroud, Bentner has to come on. But also the fact that they just have so many central midfielders. I mean, they destroyed Napoli basically with 5 central midfielders until Walcott and Podolski comes back. And bear in mind, we're talking about Walcott and Podolski. We're not talking about Stanley Matthews, Garrincha, and Luis Figo. You know, until those guys come back, they don't really have any natural wide players. Even if they're all fit, is this going to be an issue? I mean, clearly when you have somebody like Ertzel or Ramsey on the wing, they're not going to have the same natural movements or indeed the same pace as a proper wide man, right?
Yeah, correct. But I mean, I thought for an hour yesterday, Wilshere looked completely off the pace and out of sorts.
So did Jamie Carragher. I don't often get to watch their analysis, but he absolutely bludgeoned him for those who watch it on TV, which, from the way you're looking at me, might have been only me. I guess you guys were all watching the Times Goal app.
I was actually there, so I was about 100 yards away from Carragher, but didn't see him.
Right. I was at Carrow Road working.
Wilshere was poor for an hour, really poor for an hour, and yet the final half hour he really came into the game and the balance seemed right. I thought they created an awful lot of openings in that final half hour, and I thought Arsenal were pretty good. I thought it was a pretty decent performance against a very good competitive West Brom team, and yes, they do lack width, but they seem to be finding another way of playing with so much going through Ozil in the middle that they don't necessarily need width from their sort of wide forwards. If the fullbacks attack, I mean, you could look at Barcelona's front three, and if it's been Pedro, Alexis, Villa, Iniesta, whoever, they've never had great width in terms of those players, but the width comes from elsewhere, the fullbacks.
I might respectfully point out, Ollie, that Barcelona have Dani Alves and Jordi Alba as their fullbacks, whereas Arsenal have Jenkinson, Sanya, and Gibbs.
I thought particularly against Napoli, the Arsenal fullbacks were very good getting forward. Yeah. I think the Arsenal fullbacks' issue is when they're on the edge of their own box.
There is, as always, truth in moderation. I suspect with Arsenal that the issue of not having that natural width against teams like West Brom won't be a problem. But even when you take a slight step up to Marseille, as I was in Marseille for the Arsenal game when Wilshere played wide left, and Marseille aren't a great side by any stretch of the imagination, I think they're probably a little bit better than West Brom, maybe not a vast amount. Wilshere basically decided he didn't like playing on the left, so he drifted inside and got in Ozil's way, and it totally robbed Arsenal, who made a very good start, of any rhythm throughout the game. I suspect against better sides that will be a problem, that lack of width, the fact that you've got three players there who want to play in the same place.
You mentioned Jack Wilshere and this story of him smoking we're adults here, but what I found interesting though was, well, I think, Rory, you pointed this out about sort of his entourage saying that it was all a part of a prank. And then
what a terrible prank.
Yeah, and the tweet about Zidane.
What a terrible excuse. It's a 14-year-old's excuse, isn't it? You know, I did it for a day. Yeah, we believe you, Jack. We're stupid.
Should he just not say, why don't y'all mind your own business? And
oh, but you're not allowed to, are you? Does it mean he is, whether he should be or shouldn't be? And the answer to that is he shouldn't be. Footballers are role models. So he obviously has to come out and publicly condemn smoking, because that's what kind of a responsible person who lots of kids look at as a role model would do.
Is Sebastian Coe a role model?
Not for me, no.
No, seriously. Is Lord Coe a role model?
Not in the same sense as...
All right, so go to Wikipedia, find out about his life, and then put your role model BS. And I'm not even saying you, but all these people moralize over Jack Wilshere having a cigarette. These are your role models. Boris Johnson, find out about him. Or how many freaking kids does Ken Livingstone have, right? These are role models?
Well, the thing is...
I take it we're cutting this bit.
Cutting this bit. They're not even rock stars. Sorry.
Do you want your role models to lie about what they do? So, like, this is your role model. Like, so Jack Wilshere, he's a role model. When you get caught, lie.
I agree that footballers shouldn't be role models, but that is why Wilshere will come out and have done that weird thing. A, come up with the excuse that he wasn't smoking it when you look at the pictures, he clearly was. That was someone taking a drag, and fair play to him. Then done the weird thing of tweeting the picture of Zidane, who did smoke, one of many footballers who did smoke and do smoke. There's plenty who do. It's fairly, not common, but it's not exactly rare. And then denying that he smoked at all. It's just, the whole thing was a massive mess. But I think the key point here is that it's not very important.
Surprised nobody's brought up Garrincha having a cigarette as he walked off the pitch at halftime.
Socrates smoked. Zidane smoked. There are loads and loads of loads who still do. It's not like... I don't want to get in trouble, but you can name loads.
Didn't George Best sniff glue before every game?
Oh, stop it now.
My granddad who we should talk about more,
when
he was playing for Coventry and Birmingham, had a stake before the game, about an hour before the game, because they felt it made them more manly. And at half time, the entire team had a coffee and a fag.
Okay, but back then, that was in the 1930s. People were unaware of the dangers associated.
Yeah, but
sure, nobody had any idea. They thought all that coughing was normal.
Yeah, well, that baffles me slightly. They must have felt that it was bad for them. Anyway, smoking in football is not rare, is my point.
Do you smoke cigarettes or opium?
Cigarettes, opium, just huge joints.
The daft thing about it is it's only in England and only in Britain, really, that there would be such a weird outrage surrounding an athlete or a footballer smoking. I mean, obviously, if you smoke 20 a day, then that's not going to do your lungs much good. That's not going to make you do wonders for your aerobic capacity. But only in England could a guy be coming out of a nightclub and with a cigarette in his hand, and you think, well, he's probably had a few drinks, and we focus on the cigarettes. I mean, I'm not talking about
that is an absolutely brilliant point. And Wenger raised that issue when it was mentioned to him. He said that England is far more sensitive to smoking than other countries. In Macedonia, the Macedonian national team, the boys who were out in Skopje, Ollie was probably there before they played England, whenever it was sat in a cafe smoking. It happens. Other countries have far less puritanical approaches to it. I would be more concerned if I was Wenger from the fact that Jack Wilshere was on a night out in the middle of the week. I know they'd had a day off, but to me, that shouldn't be happening.
Right, Tottenham fans, you thought you were getting away with it, but no, this week we actually have three games in our Premier League review, and a briefer debate, because hopefully we will all agree, or at least you'll agree with me. West Ham, who I don't believe had scored an away goal this season, go to Spurs, who had only conceded twice all season long, and win 3-0. Tony, explain. Does this mean that statistics are all just lies and horrible predictors of what's going to happen?
It means the league's all over the place this year. It means Tottenham made a lot of changes in the summer and haven't bedded down, and they're not getting the goals you'd think they would have hoped for. It means that Sam outthought AVB, and Sam is the real football hipster. You know. Well, who knows what it means? Who knows? What we're going to see this season, I think the way the league is we're going to see loads of results like this. We're going to see results that seem to come out of the blue and everyone goes, didn't see that coming. And it can only be good. Actually, you can't really analyse it. Do you want us to make it up and lie? Do you want us to be like Jack Wilshere and say, oh, wasn't smoking? Oh, yes, I'll give you my analysis. It's because West Ham set up as a 4-7-6-5-1. And you know what? Some things you just can't explain. Accept it!
I love the echo on that as well.
Next week. Roy, do you want to comment on Allardyce's 4-6-0 formation?
I do. I want to point out that, to be fair to Sam, I don't think he was claiming that it was inspired by Spain and Barcelona. I think it was more inspired by Scotland. But to borrow a line from Hughesy, who wrote about it in the paper today, but I would point out that playing a false nine when what you've done is you've shoved Mohamed Diame up front isn't really the same thing as playing a false nine. That's playing a midfielder as a striker.
But I thought Allardyce was very honest, actually. He said, like, he defended in numbers. He didn't have a fit striker. And he said, I sent runners from midfield.
Yeah, that's what you do.
When Spalletti did it at Roma, he was the genius who had reinvented the feet with the wheel, right?
Yeah, he came for a draw and nicked a goal and then got another couple.
But, Ollie, might I submit to you, though, that while I agree with Tony, when you do it as a one-off in a game like this, it's a bit different than actually working on the system during preseason and using it perhaps more frequently, using it in certain situations. I mean, is that the difference between a tactical innovation or having a tactical plan and just kind of improvising on the day because of injuries?
Well, from what I could see, it looked like they slightly rotated the front four, and that Vaste spent periods up front, and Diame did, and that they seemed to rotate it in that way. If we talk about sort of a team throwing it together and hoping that it works on the night, then, I mean, isn't that what Mourinho did at Old Trafford in, whenever that was, the end of August, when they went there and it was a 0-0 draw and they had Schürrle up front and it didn't really work? And that didn't look like it had been particularly worked on. Obviously, it's Manchester United away. It's not an easy fixture, even now. But that didn't look particularly like it had been worked on and like there was a great understanding of the roles. Whereas from everything I read and see and hear about West Ham yesterday, that there did seem to be a basic understanding of what.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
The players were meant to be doing when they were the ones selected to go through the middle. And Allardyce, say what you like about him, but when his teams go onto the pitch, they know what they're doing, they know what their job is, and if it's something slightly different for a game like this, then you can bet that they worked on it.
Well, I'm sure they did work on it, and I agree with you that he's good at executing, but you know, it's not like, I'm not suggesting that he just woke up that morning and did it, but obviously, if you've only had 1 week to prepare for this, it's not going to be the same thing.
I want to praise Sam Allardyce for something else.
What?
I want to praise him for the way that he has rehabilitated Ravel Morrison to the point where he might actually become quite a good professional footballer. I think he deserves immense credit for that.
Well, Allardyce says that he deserves no credit for it, and it was all down to Ravel, and he had to be the one willing to help himself, which makes him even more charitable in my mind.
It does, and you can't praise Moyes, say, for using Adnan Yanazai as a youngster and entrusting to the youngster, and then allow Allardyce to say, well, it's nothing to do with me, Gov, it's entirely Ravel. I think he deserves a huge amount of credit for trusting in Morrison, for seeing the potential, for seeing that he could come through his difficulties and trusting him this season.
For those who are unfamiliar with Ravel Morrison, because not everybody might know the story, obviously his background is a very gifted player at Manchester United. He got into some very serious legal trouble involving, and again, with this weirdo legal system you have, Tony, I'm sure you're more familiar with libel laws, but please interrupt me if I say something that I shouldn't be saying. But he was accused of intimidating a witness, is that right?
Yeah, you're allowed to say that.
Okay.
Yep.
I just never quite know because, you know, I'm worried that, you know, Chief Justice Tuggenhat, whatever the hell his name is, might come after me. And
Lord Justice Kay.
If you say he killed a man in a bar fight, you'll probably get into trouble.
Okay.
But
all right.
Not this.
He didn't do that.
Unless he did.
Unless, of course, he did.
So,
which, can we just make sure people are clear on this?
For the avoidance
Ravel
of doubt.
Morrison did not, as far as we know, kill a man in a bar fight.
Now, if he did intimidate a witness, is there not obvious possibility that he did it for a prank?
I almost wonder if maybe he shouldn't have gone out and intimidated the witnesses who basically ratted Jack Wilshere out. And that might have been a more positive thing to do. But
that was a classic. That was a classic tabloid. An onlooker said, by which they mean the paparazzi.
Yeah, exactly. But about Morrison's goal, I think on TV they said, "Oh, shades of Michael Owen." Now, Argentina defended better, I thought, against Owen than Vertonghen and especially Dawson. What was going through Dawson's mind when he did that?
Well, we Exactly. And, I mean, you know, let's not get carried away with either Ravel Morrison or a Manchester United player whose name I can't pronounce. You know what? You have good days. And
Ashley Young?
Let's see how it goes. Yeah, Ashley Young. Let's see how it goes over the course of a season, and let's see if we're still talking about them this time next year.
That is absolutely true. And I would also like to add that with Ravel Morrison, there is this temptation that whenever anyone scores a goal that involves running from their own half, that it's compared to either Michael Owen or George Weah against Verona. There is a big difference in sprinting unchallenged from your own half, which is a fine feat of athleticism that I couldn't do, to beating an entire team of players.
It is, I mean, hey, Ollie, I know we can mark, we can be patient. I get excited because the guy looks good, because he's elegant, because he's balanced. It is also true that Dawson didn't defend at all, and Vertonghen, who's one of the slower center halves in the Premier League, you know, that's the guy he was outrunning, right?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't, as I always said, you know, Diego Maradona in the Aztec in 1986. It wasn't that kind of goal. It was a goal where he sprinted away from somebody and then he got round somebody, and he did it all very well and finished nicely. People shouldn't obsess about Morrison's goal. I think people should look at the type of player he is, which is composed, precise, well-balanced, intelligent, on the ball, that is, on the pitch, that is, and say that, you know, he is exactly the type of player that English football for years didn't produce. And there are now these players such as Wiltshire, such as Barkley, such as Morrison, who are more elegant, more composed on the ball, and seem to be more conducive to the sort of passing game that we've all been saying England can't play.
All right, before,
that to me is the encouraging thing with him. I wouldn't get carried away about the goal, but his performances generally, and you could tell right from the first League Cup game he played for Man United and in the youth team and so on, that he is an extremely good footballer.
Now, our debate this week will hopefully be a little bit open and shut, because I'm assuming that we're all in agreement with the first part of the debate. Adnan Januzaj, we've seen him several times. We first saw him, first saw him in the Charity Shield, because unlike Ollie, I don't snoop around Manchester United youth games. But he looks really good. He scored 2 goals this weekend. And now they have this issue out of the blue where David Moyes comes out and says, well, the FA have been in touch about naturalizing him. And, you know, when he – because the kid is Belgian, born in Belgium, raised in Belgium, of Albanian Kosovo descent. He hasn't played for anybody internationally. So theoretically, he could be naturalized as English in 2.5 years' time. And Roy Hodgson, asked about this on Match of the Day, comes out and says, well, when the time comes, we'll consider it. Anybody think that, leaving aside the footballing perspective, that from an ethical perspective, there is any reason whatsoever to even consider naturalizing this guy?
No, but I think at the same time, it's important to distinguish between a case like that and a case like Berahino for the under-21s, who came to England as a political refugee at the age of 10. I think in that case, it's fine. I think if you import a kid to a Premier League club's youth academy because he's good, solely because of his footballing ability, to naturalise him is completely unethical.
So we're basically in agreement that there's a difference between somebody who's come here as a political refugee when he was 9 and somebody who's simply come here because Manchester United came and took him from his club at 16. Exactly. Gave him a big wad of money.
Okay, which should be outlawed under international law anyway, but yes. Yeah.
All right, so nobody's in favour of naturalising Januzaj?
No.
I think it would be...
England.
I think it would be a massive confession of weakness.
Ollie, is this Zola Budd?
I would struggle to remember what age Zola Budd was, but she was... The point is, really, that in other sports, there seems to be far less... moralizing about this type of thing. I mean,
because those are other less serious minority sports.
Well, less serious sports and sports where there seems to be this belief that we Britain should do everything we can to maximise chances of getting as many gold medals as possible. I mean, there was this sort of plastic Brits debate going into the last Olympics. Now, some people would call Berahino a plastic Brit. I certainly wouldn't. Some people would call Januzaj a potential plastic Brit, and I think that's a different one. But then I think this where this debate has real merit is we've seen people like Victor Moses who were eligible to play for England. Very similar situation to Berahino, where he came over at 11, I think, and was eligible to play for England, and England were too slow off the mark, and by the time he wanted to commit to somebody, he was already sort of in the Nigeria fold, and England had been slow. And the FA, I mean, I was speaking to somebody from the FA this morning about this whole issue, and the view is that they need to be a whole lot more proactive about this, because they've been slow off the mark, they've been reactive, if that. And they're seeing other countries, including Spain, adopt players, and England, who arguably can not afford to do that, are missing out on players. And
I feel that although
Yanazai and those who are sort of imported into Premier League academies because they're good, I think that is a different case. But I feel that the FA and England need to be pushing the boundaries further with this dual nationality thing. Because, I mean, Lewis Holtby's another. They didn't even...
Lewis Holtby's
make
dad
a move for him until he was
from Liverpool.
Captain of the... Well, yeah, he was captain of the Germany under 21 team by the time anyone from the FA.
But this is part of the reason why I have a problem with Alex Horn, and, or maybe it wasn't him who you spoke to, though I suspect it probably was. But I
certainly not.
Okay, there we go. It's definitely not Alex Horn. What kind of muddled up thinking is this? If you're going to go scour for people who have English roots and who might have fallen through the cracks or whatever, it's one thing. But Adnan Yanazai is a completely different case. Beyond the fact that his contract's up at the end of the season, and for all you know, he could be living somewhere else in 9 months' time. I mean, what the hell are you doing?
Well, there's the problem. The Premier League academies are importing kids of very young ages from all over the world, from Brazil. And this, you know, the FA slow off the mark and reactive. No, surely not the FA. But, like, you've got a situation, you hear a Brazilian kid comes over, he's at an academy, all of a sudden he looks good at 17 or 18. Oh, yeah, let's try and make him naturalise. It's crap. Wrong.
I think it's important because I understand where Ollie's coming from, and other countries, it's true, do not have quite the same kind of ethical principles, whatever it is, as the FA seem to be claiming.
Johnny Foreigner does
not
have
ethical
principles.
Well, no, because you look at Marcos Senna was not Spanish, but they naturalised him and he won Euro 2008 with them.
Can I just say, other than Spain, what other countries are you thinking of?
Well, I think you could make a case, off the top of my head, the French 98 and 2000 squad was full of players. A lot of those players weren't born in France.
Right, but they were all raised.
Well, no, but this is the point I want to make.
That's a difference. There's a distinction, and I'll leave something in a minute, but I think it's important to remind ourselves of the rules, okay? Every country has their own naturalization rules, right?
Yep.
Qatar decided a few years ago that, we'll just give passports to whoever we like and pay them to come, and that's why Ailton became Qatari for a way, and then FIFA decided to cut it out. And then, broadly speaking, they've accepted that you can be naturalized, obviously, based on grandparents or parents, or you can be naturalized based on residency. And rules vary slightly from country to country, but in England, it's five years, right? On top of that, the FA, together with the other home nations over issues such as David Johnson and Manuel and Mooney and so on, decided to adopt a gentleman's agreement where they said that they wouldn't naturalize anybody unless they'd had 5 years schooling before the age of 18 in any one of those territories, right? So it would have meant, for example, Michael Owen could have theoretically played for Wales if he'd wanted to. But this is the weird thing, right? Having signed to this gentleman's agreement, now it's just all going out the window because, look, we can sign Yanazai.
Well, so that's what I was going to say. Ollie's right to an extent, but there's a huge amount of difference in all of these cases. So Holtby has English blood, so that's fine. That's different. If you look at countries like Switzerland, where Granit Xhaka and Sherdan Shaqiri, who are both Kosovar Albanian, are playing for them, they arrived as political refugees. Again, they came to the country and have residency there for reasons other than football. When you start,
that's fine. Nobody has a problem with that.
So these circumstances are all different. What England are now talking about, and I agree, it's contrary to this agreement, is basically, it's a form of trafficking to bring the kids in. It's what Qatar wanted to do, to bring the kids in younger and turn them into English people purely because of their ability, and that is deeply, deeply unethical. Mm. That's the problem. That's where it becomes very unsettling to try and do that.
So, Ollie, do you agree it's unethical? Are you going to get on Dyke's rear end and be like, hey, Greg, this is kind of stupid? He's such a man of the people, right?
That's a weird image.
I would say that Januzaj would be a case too far for me because there's nothing about him that's English, and he would be having to be sort of parked up, rejecting other countries to which have a more stronger claim to him in order to become eligible for England potentially in the future. Germany did it with the boy Kakao, didn't they? About 10 years ago.
I'm glad you mentioned Kakao, right? Because I'm sure the FA are going to put out Kakao, so I just want to settle the facts on Kakao. Kakao came to Germany when he was 19 years old. He was not a political refugee. He was an economic migrant. He played for an amateur side. He lived, after 9 years in Germany, he was naturalized, and then he played a few times with the German national team. I think that's a different situation.
Well, I know it is a different situation, but it's similar to the kind of Almunia,
Arteta
type. I'd say it's different because Ollie, but it's different because Almunia and Arteta were millionaire footballers before they came here. Kakao was a guy who moved to Germany for non-footballing reasons. Almunia was a professional footballer playing for Celta in the Spanish First Division. He even played in the Champions League. He was like, what, 22, 23 when he came over?
Yeah, but he wasn't a superstar he wasn't the sort of superstar player that was being groomed to become English. He's a player who, after a certain period of England of playing in England, he would have become eligible to play for England and wasn't eligible to, and wasn't wanted by his country of birth. So we're looking at the same, it's the same ballpark, isn't it? But I just find it quite laughable, really, that England as a football nation should be more resistant to this idea when we're sort of less interested in English identity in almost every other respect of football, not least recruiting foreign managers. Which other major football nation, if we can still call ourselves that, employs foreign managers for the national team? Which other major football nations are sort of dominated by foreign owners? It's a very strange sort of moralizing that we have in England, where I think nationality is becoming so blurred, and yet you would still hear people saying, "Well, it's a good job, it's a good job England didn't go for Victor Moses because he's not English, he's Nigerian." Well, England had a great right to go for Victor Moses and Lewis Holtby and people like that, and they didn't go for it. And I'd say those are the cases I regret rather than obsessing about Januzaj.
I think that's an excellent point about managers, and I personally would say that having a foreign manager is cheating, because your national side represents the strength of your nation, and the manager is a key part of that. I don't see why it's separate. The other thing I'd like to say, on Match of the Day, Roy Hodgson obviously was on Match of the Day, Alan Shearer, they were talking about the Januzaj issue, and Alan Shearer said maybe, he would want to, play for the best possible team at international level. That is an absolutely appalling view of international football. If international football becomes that, where people can pick and choose who they play for because they're the best team, there is no point in it. We should abolish it.
United get all 3 points at Sunderland thanks to Adnan Januzaj, who we've just discussed. But for most of the game, they serve up another stinker. Tony, how much of this is David Moyes' fault?
Very little, I would have thought.
Blame the Glazers, blame the Glazers.
Yeah, blame the Glazers. You know what? This has been building since the Glazers took over in 2005. £680 million has gone out of the club on interest payments and on servicing the loans. If that would have been put on players, then, how much of a different situation would they be in? And Alex Ferguson in part facilitated that, because he was a genius and he made an inferior squad perform significantly better than they should have. And Moyes has got the poison chalice, and, he needs a bit of time, but it doesn't look great.
There you go, Sir Alex. It's your fault because you were just too good. And that's a Liverpool fan saying that. Harry Redknapp has a new book out, and he reveals something that I'm told Matt Dickinson revealed some 18 months ago, which is that he was sure that he was going to get the England job and he was going to appoint Brendan Rodgers as his assistant. Now, personally, why a man from Northern Ireland would have wanted to be Harry Redknapp's assistant with England when he could go and manage Liverpool is something that's a bit difficult for me to understand. But hey, Ollie, perhaps you've got better insight than I do. Give me an alternative history of England with Harry and Brendan Rodgers as a managerial dream team.
I think probably if you envisage an alternative England under Redknapp, would they have perhaps won one and lost one out of the two dour draws. Would they have perhaps been a little bit too open in Ukraine and got beaten? Would they have won away to Poland? I think it would be that kind of thing. I think it would be better to watch, more seat of the pants, and perhaps lose more games. But I think they'd be roughly in the same place, but maybe would be more fun to watch.
So Redknapp, Hodgson, much of a muchness there. I'll leave it up to you to decide whether they are equally good or equally bad. Manchester City get all 3 points against Everton and rediscover some guy named David Silva, who I thought had disappeared. Rory, where was he hiding? And is there a place for him in Pellegrini's best 11?
He was hiding in a hollowed-out volcano in the South China Sea, plotting a takeover of the world. He's been injured, Gab. He's struggled with injury. Where do you think he's been? Whether there's a place for him in the team, though, is a very interesting question, because I think he slows down City's play. David Silva's one of those people that we all love watching play. He's brilliant to watch, but he's not been as effective the last 2 years as he was in his first season. And at the moment, I'm not sure whether City functions slightly better without him, although he did play very well against Everton.
Roberto Martinez, though, is unhappy, and he feels referee John Moss gave City a very soft penalty that would have changed the game. Indeed, Martinez came out and went so far as to say that Moss killed the game. Tony, is he right? And given that we all have this warm and fuzzy love Roberto Martinez feeling right now, should he really be having pops at referees?
Well, you know, I think he should be having a pop at his player, who not only leans in, puts his arm, and actually makes contact with the forward. You know, I mean, it's a penalty.
You're contradicting Roberto Martinez.
Yeah, I'm contradicting Roberto Martinez, and I'm also probably contradict him on his genius as a football manager as well. Everton have had a good start. Let's see if it continues.
Oh, we have an England question, so a good thing Ollie's here. Two home games, two wins, and you're home free, right? Is Hart Roy Hodgson's biggest concern when it comes to England right now?
I think he's one of the concerns, because he's let in a few dodgy goals recently, but I don't think he's the weak link in this team. I think the weak link is perhaps the back four, even though their defensive record has been good. I think they always look vulnerable at Wembley to intelligent counter-attacking teams, two of which they're just about to face. They also often look very careless and nervous in possession. So I think there are numerous concerns. I think England will scrape through, but I'm concerned about various things, and Hart is just one of them.
Chelsea win at Carrow Road with some help from England backup John Ruddy. Rory, Ruddy aside, give me three good things Mourinho can take from this game.
Demba Ba did okay, which suggests he's got another option up front, which I suppose is a positive. A more physical presence than either Eto or Torres. Chelsea won, which they didn't look like they were going to, as Norwich, to be honest, kind of slaughtered them a little bit for most of the second half. I suppose one positive is that the game is over and Chelsea have won it. And what else? Mata and Oscar, I suppose, sort of dovetailing quite nicely, looking like they might be able to link up in a Mourinho system. That was a positive. It was a good 3 points for Chelsea, that, because Norwich were very impressive, particularly kind of the middle 30 minutes of the game.
So we should give credit to Mourinho for getting his message to Mata and having Mata.
Yeah, and also, to be fair, his proactive substitutions, the fact that they cost 70 million quid between them probably helped, but he did make attacking substitutions, and that's always nice to see. Gab, I've got a question for you. It's very exciting. Bayern Munich and Bayer Leverkusen in the Bundesliga, a chance for my close personal friend Sammy Hupia to make the title race there what Vince McMahon would refer to as a three-way dance. How did he do?
Well, he got a point, and they celebrated at the final whistle as if they'd won the Champions League. It means that they're still 1 point behind Bayern Munich at the top of the table, and it's even better because Borussia Dortmund lost to Borussia Mönchengladbach. But Bayer Leverkusen play awful football. I watched them like six times this year. It's one thing to play direct football. It's another thing to have like four guys at the back, this giant called Reinhardt's in midfield, like kicking everything in sight, Bender doing his thing, and then and basically just lumping balls to Kiesling. This was one of the most one-sided games. Bayern Munich had 78% possession. They had 27 shots on goal. They could have killed this game earlier. I was so disappointed with Bayer Leverkusen at home. I'm not against direct football, but there's got to be some rhyme or reason to it, some support. And I don't know. I mean, I know Hopi is a nice guy, but goodness me, he's got to do better. All right, that's all we got time for right now. But you can come see us live in Birmingham and then later on in Newcastle, where maybe you'll even meet George Culkin, you know, and he'll post some pictures for you. And later on, of course, in Manchester as well. The links are on Twitter. They're on our SoundCloud page. Rory, I'm told, and this is Skinner Scripts, so it must be true, will even read some of the self-penned poetry he writes in Spanish, mostly odes to Marcelo Bielsa and Luis Suarez. And of course, strictly written in Rio Platense Spanish. Till next time, thanks to my guests, Ollie Kay, Tony Evans, and of course, Rory K. Smith. Bye-bye.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.